In Augusta, Georgia today, the big question heading into the final round of the Masters Golf Tournament is, how does it top yesterday? Normally, the third round is a mere prelude to Sunday's finale, but yesterday stood by itself as one of the great days in a major championship. Electrifying shots, roars from all corners of Augusta National Golf Club, and some of the biggest names in the game at or near the top of the leaderboard. From Augusta, NPR's Tom Goldman reports.
It was late in the afternoon. Down in famed Amen Corner, the giant scoreboard changed again for England's Lee Westwood from 11 under par to 12 under. Murmurs in the gallery. He's running away with it. It's his time. On cue, a roar from a nearby crowd. It came from the direction of the 13th green. The murmur now turned to chatter. That's Mickelson's group. Sounded like an eagle roar, which is louder and more spirited than a birdie roar. Indeed, the man nicknamed Lefty, Phil Mickelson, had eagled number 13 and kicked Saturday into overdrive. He was now just three shots behind Westwood. Two under par eagles are a big deal. Two in a row? Golfers had done that only twice in Masters history until yesterday. They were still buzzing around the 14th green just minutes after Mickelson hit his second shot from the 14th fairway into the cup for back-to-back eagles. Now 11 under, one behind Westwood. And on he went to the par 5 15th, where he chipped his third shot over water onto the green, and come on, you cannot be serious. No. It wasn't a third eagle in a row, but oh so close.
It went across the hole from my viewpoint, but it was about 8 inches behind it. But as it was crossing the hole, I was expecting it to disappear, yeah.
Alas, only a one-under-par birdie, but enough to pull Mickelson into a tie with Westwood. For Mickelson, incredible momentum. For Westwood, a five-shot lead gone. Poof, the kind of thing that can shatter a golfer's confidence, but not Westwood's.
Because what Phil Mickelson does is really out of my control. Well, the only thing I can control, as I've said all week, is what I do, where I hit it.
Westwood, in a bubble of solitude and concentration during the round, said he had no room for thinking about what somebody else was doing. Just the opposite with Mickelson.
I do look at the leaderboard quite a bit to see who's doing what. I think it's fun. You see the roars and you try to figure out who did what, and the leaderboard tells you.
Yesterday's leaderboard told the tale of lots of up-and-down performances, a function, Mickelson said, of the warm weather and what he called receptive greens, prompting a lot of players to take risks, like he did on 13, when he hit a long shot to the green instead of playing it safe. And Mickelson predicted more of the same today.
I think the course can be set up similarly in that you can make some birdies and challenge some pins. I think it's going to be an exciting Sunday.
Mickelson and Westwood will be paired in the final group of the day. In 18 of the last 19 Masters, the champion has come from that final pairing, which would spoil a dream ending for Tiger Woods, who's tied for third, four shots back, and in the next-to-last group on the Sunday of his comeback tournament. Tom Goldman, NPR News, Augusta.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Stories about wild children have been around since ancient times. They also pop up in the news. Abandoned child found living with animals, walks on all fours, unable to speak. These youngsters become objects of curiosity, even exploitation. But their stories of survival are extraordinary. Australian writer Eva Horning takes on this time-honored tale in her new novel, Dog Boy. More from NPR's Lynn Neary.
One of the cornerstones of Western civilization was built on the myth of the wild child. The twin brothers Romulus and Remus, raised by a she-wolf, were the founders of Rome. Then there's Mowgli of the Jungle Book fame, now perhaps best known in the Disney version. And of course, Tarzan, king of the jungle, who in this 1984 film is discovered by a European explorer and educated in the ways of humans.
And in 6 months, he has managed to grasp the rudiments of the language. But now I have to convince him of who he is. Indeed, what he is.
It is that question of who or what the Wild Child is that has intrigued people so much through the ages. Whether the story is pure fiction or based on the discovery of a real child, the idea of a vulnerable human living among animals fascinates. Michael Newton is the author of Savage Girls and Wild Boys, A History of Feral Children.
There is a long history of the idealization of such children of nature, as they were sometimes called.
Over the years, Newton says, feral children have been both romanticized and victimized. They are, he says, objects of both desire and disgust.
They're imagined as being visionary beings who are closer to nature than we are, who experience things more fully, who are more passionate, who can live in the moment in ways that rational, civilized people can't. At the same time, they're smelly, they're slovenly, they eat horribly. And it's that combination of a desire to be in these children's position and at the same time a kind of recoil from what it would mean to really live as an animal that really goes to the heart of such stories.
Since writing his book, Newton says he is regularly notified of the existence of a new wild child. Sometimes these discoveries prove to be hoaxes, but many are not. One of the most famous in recent years was the story of Ivan Mishakov, who lived with a pack of wild dogs in Moscow for 2 years. It was this story that caught the attention of Eva Hornung.
What gripped my imagination at the time, I think, is what would grip anyone, is imagining a child living with dogs through minus 27 degree winters with no cooked food, presumably, and with no heating. And so it got its claws into me, so to speak.
In Hornig's novel, the boy is 4-year-old Romichka. Abandoned by his mother just as Russia's harsh winter is approaching, he finds warmth, nourishment, and companionship with a pack of dogs. But Hornig's story is no fairy tale. She has imagined the life of a dog so thoroughly you can almost smell the stench of the den. Because Romichka lives in a city instead of a jungle and could already speak before living with the dogs, Hornig envisions him moving between the human world and the dog world as needed.
I had this notion that Romichka could demonstrate something I know, which is the enormous flexibility and mutability of human selfhood. Romichka ends up with not a selfhood that is less than human, but one that is more, that encompasses a kind of doghood as well as a boyhood. And he is able to exploit boyhood or doghood according to where he feels he will have the best chance of survival.
Though Romichka's life with the dogs is brutal and at times violent, it is his encounters with humans which prove to be the most horrifying. He lives on the outskirts of Moscow, where gangs of homeless children prey on the vulnerable, and the police, who are supposed to protect the innocent, torment them instead. In this excerpt, read by Hornig, Romichka has been picked up by the police and retreats completely into being a dog to escape their brutality.
His self was a dog's self, a set of known trails, ways, and places to be between these boundaries. The present was not good. He thought about it little. He ate glumly, fought when there was opportunity, and snarled to comfort himself. Despite this retreat, however, another feeling crept over him, like the season tipping from summer to autumn. It seeped into him, quelling all other feelings. It was sadness, and with it came, first in moments, then more often, the snowfall of despair.
Feral children, says Michael Newton, are often the victims of abuse. They're abandoned by those who should take care of them, yet when people encounter them, they're not accepted as fully human.
These children, on one level, represent really extreme instances of human cruelty, and then they also transcend that cruelty, and it moves into a kind of reconciliation with nature, and nature, which is often thought of as hostile to human beings, is suddenly revealed to be more kindly than human beings are themselves.
Eva Hornig says her story is not so much about setting animals above humans, but she does want to challenge her ideas about what it means to be human.
I think holding animals at a very great distance from ourselves and seeing ourselves as distinct from animals allows us great freedom in what we do with animals. And that fascinates me. It fascinates me that our definition of being human is so flawed.
Romichka's rescue at the end of the book raises as many questions as it answers, because as he prepares to enter the world of humans once and for all, it is clear that he's leaving an important part of himself behind in the den he once called home. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
And you're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. It's a safe bet that the last thing you'd do after losing your job is give away money. Reed Sandridge was laid off last year as director of a nonprofit group in Washington, D.C. The 36-year-old came up with a pet project to keep him busy while he looked for work. He calls it the Year of Giving. Every day, Sandridge walks up to a stranger and gives away $10. So far, he's handed out close to $1,200. He also interviews the recipients about their lives and posts their stories on his blog. Think of it as Studs Terkel meets Santa Claus. Reed Sandridge agreed to meet us in Washington, D.C.'s Chinatown neighborhood on a very busy corner above a metro stop. It wasn't long before he stopped someone on the street and started making his pitch.
So my name is Reed Sandridge,
uh-huh.
And would love to give him $10 today.
You must have a lot of money to be able to do that.
What is your name?
It's Molly, M-O-L-L-Y.
What are you doing today?
I am should be studying, and instead I'm going to go shopping.
So what do you think you might use the $10 for?
In all honesty, I'm going to probably use it on Starbucks.
Do you practice any giving on your own?
I did like tutoring for a shelter, and then Thursdays, well, it was a transitional housing program, and then Thursdays I taught an exercise class for women at a shelter.
Could I take a photo or a quick video of you?
Initially, I was reluctant to stop with my bike helmet, my unshowered hair.
Come on.
While we're waiting for your picture, I'm Leanne Hansen from National Public Radio.
Okay.
Molly, whatever possessed you to stop when this guy in a pink tie said, "Can I speak to you for a minute?" I mean, what went through your mind first?
Well, generally, first, I'm like, is he going to ask me for money? No, generally, I'm a nice person and I'm pretty social, so.
I know you're going to spend your $10 on Starbucks, but will you pay it forward?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I believe in that strongly. It's that whole karma. What goes around comes around. Good energy. All that.
Reed, why are you doing this?
Well, I got laid off of my job back in October, and I really wanted to concentrate on doing something that would give me an opportunity to interact with my community and maybe inspire others. But when I got laid off and I had this idea, I started thinking, can I do this? So I looked at what's the worst case scenario. Worst case scenario was 1 year without work.
Yeah, but you haven't found a job yet, right?
Nope, I'm usually not so dressed up, but I'm going to a job interview, so.
Beautiful pink polka dot tie, white shirt, gray suit, you're the perfect model of a job interviewee.
Great, thank you.
So what other kinds of people have you given your money away to?
I've given to homeless people. I've given to executives of company. I gave to the president of a small brewery. I gave to all kinds of people. I think that's what makes it interesting is to actually get a diverse group of individuals.
Has anyone turned you down?
Lots of people have turned me down.
What reasons do they give?
The most common reason is people say that they don't feel that they're deserving. And I didn't want to kind of influence people's decision, but at some point, I've started telling people, if you don't feel that you're deserving, you don't necessarily need to keep it. You could do anything you want with it. And I'm still surprised that I would say most of those people who deny or decline to participate, even after I tell them that, they still choose not to participate.
Ah.
Maybe they just don't have time. I hear a lot of times, I don't want to get involved.
And there were people worried you want something from them for that $10, and really all you want is their story.
Yes, there was a great woman I approached one day, and I said, can you help me with a project? She goes, I don't have any money. And I said, well, that's great, because I'm going to give you $10.
Reed Sandridge, thanks a lot, and good luck on your job interview later.
Thank you very much.
You can find a link to Reed's blog by going to our website, npr.org.